24872, Suarez versus Morton et al.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Alexandra Avocado for Elvin Suarez. In granting summary judgment, the district court misconstrued the deliberate indifference standard and misapplied key summary judgment principles. Once those errors are corrected, the record shows that each defendant knew of a risk that Mr. Suarez would decompensate without medical treatment and in his conditions of confinement. On appeal, defendants highlight the evidence favorable to them, but they fail to grapple with the competing evidence of their knowledge as they must on summary judgment. And they treat as dispositive Mr. Suarez's statements that he was fine and didn't need medication. But the record shows that defendants knew they could not rely on those statements.
Okay, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way I was imagining this, and you can tell me if there's any daylight, is that you have two theories. One is that the decompensation was so obvious that it seems clear that the defendants were recklessly ignoring it. The other is that there were medical advice in his files to not take him off his medication, which the defendants knew of, and they ignored it. Are those the theories?
I think those are two different ways that the court could, two different theories that the court could rely on to reverse here, and they do intersect with one another. In a world even where those medical records didn't exist, defendants' experience and training and the symptoms that they observed would have made the risk of decompensation sufficiently obvious. We have statements from defendants in the record indicating that they knew that there was a risk Mr. Suarez would decompensate without his medication.
So what were those symptoms, right? I mean, because we need to figure out that there's a factual dispute as to clinicians about whether they adequately provided the medication that they were supposed to.
Of course. So just, before I answer that, I'll just flag that, again, as Your Honor recognized, even had there been no symptoms of active decompensation, defendants' knowledge of the risk of decompensation would be sufficient to create a triable dispute here. But, of course, as Your Honor notes, each defendant saw symptoms of active decompensation. Just to give some examples, Kayum, Kulik, DiNardo, Mr. Suarez's treatment team knew about the violent outburst that placed Mr. Suarez in SHU, which is itself a symptom of decompensation that the district court largely ignored. They were also aware of Mr. Suarez exhibiting signs of hallucinations, like inappropriate smiling and laughter.
I thought he didn't tell anyone about his hallucinations.
He did not say, I'm experiencing hallucinations, but during sessions with at least Reynolds and Kayum, he exhibited inappropriate smiling and laughter, and it's clear from Mr. Suarez's medical records that those are indicia of hallucinations. His Kirby clinician said something.
So they should have known from the inappropriate laughter that he was, in fact, hallucinating.
It's evidence that they would have known. Again, the obviousness inquiry doesn't look to what a layman would find obvious. And so even if somebody without mental health training might not have realized that, the defendant's training and experience here as mental health professionals shows that they knew, that is evidence, that indirect evidence that they knew, particularly when considered in light of the fact that, Kayum stated, sometimes patients think that they don't need medication but begin to decompensate without it. So there's really no question he knew a risk was present here. Knowing that risk, knowing that Mr. Suarez had been in solitary confinement and witnessing signs of hallucinations is more than enough evidence for a jury to find his knowledge.
Dr. Kayum, I thought, said that one symptom is not enough to establish decompensation. And so although there was the inappropriate laughter, that itself wasn't quite enough.
He did say that in his declaration, Your Honor.
So was that bad faith? Was he lying? I mean, you need to show subjective, deliberate indifference, not just a mistake or malpractice or even negligence.
Correct. And so two answers to that. A jury could choose not to credit that statement in his after-the-fact declaration in light of the symptoms that he observed. And I'll just repeat again that, Dr. Kayum need not even have known that decompensation was actively happening. It's enough. Farmer is very clear that knowing of a risk of serious harm, in this case a risk of decompensation, is sufficient. And you know, again, in his declaration, Chaim essentially stated that his response, his proposed treatment plan, to the extent it can be called such, was to wait and see if Mr. Suarez decompensated. But of course, you know, that's deliberately indifferent to the risk of something occurring.
So what I think makes this case more factually difficult than some other cases is that Suarez was affirmatively telling his doctors that he did not want the treatment in question. And I mean, I think what would help me is the closest cases where you would find a patient both refusing a particular treatment and then the prison and the official, the doctor, should have known that they should have kept insisting.
Absolutely.
In the face of the objection. What is the case that tells me that it wasn't enough to wait and see when you have such strong objection from the patient?
I think the combination of the clear recognition from cases like like Greeson and Kemp and like Steele, that recognize that taking a patient off of antipsychotic medication that his treatment providers have made clear is necessary, is relevant here. And of course, Your Honor, I think a patient protesting that they don't need certain treatment for a knee problem or some sort of physical ailment would maybe present a harder case. But this case is really unique in that defendants knew that it was a hallmark symptom of Mr. Suarez's mental illness, that he thought he was fine and didn't need medication. Chaim has stated that it's undisputed that Kulik recognized a patient off their medication could not accurately self-report their symptoms.
They would have had to, is it correct that they would have had to get a court order to give it to him when he was refusing?
That's correct, but I think this is
so if that's correct, and I'm glad that it is, because that's what I thought. How does that play into whether or not they should have kept persisting as opposed to waiting?
Absolutely, and I'm glad to address this point, because I think in their response brief, defendants really frame this as a refusal to take medication case, and that's not what it is, and Chaim agrees with that. As he explained, once he discontinued Mr. Suarez's prescription, at no point after that was Mr. Suarez refusing to take medication. And that makes sense. You can't refuse a treatment option that's not being offered to you.
Did he even refuse in the first instance? I'm reading Dr. Chaim's notes. He just says, I don't know, it doesn't seem to help me much, doc. And he says, okay, let's stop.
We completely agree. He never refused. What he said is, I feel fine. I don't think I need medication. Those are exactly the statements that the Kirby records explain Mr. Suarez would say, and that's an expression of his mental illness. The Kirby records could not have been clearer that in response to him exhibiting that symptom, the appropriate course of treatment was to maintain his prescription and encourage compliance, because sometimes Mr. Suarez would take medication on one day and not take it on another day. But by discontinuing his prescription for over 2 months, defendants deprived him of that opportunity to do so. And by not providing him medication education, they similarly deprived him of any appropriate care. Just to say, defendant's response to this, I think, is very telling. In their response brief, they say, well, if Mr. Suarez really didn't understand that he needed medication, then what would the point of education have been? You know, to start, the records again refute that education would have been ineffective. That point also really punches a hole in defendant's primary appeal argument, which is that they had no reason to disbelieve Mr. Suarez's statements. But even assuming that, you know, medication education would have been ineffective, doing nothing in that situation is what creates deliberate indifference. Pursuing a course of treatment that is knowingly ineffectual or that is easier and less efficacious.
I thought Dr. Chaim urged Mr. Suarez to take the medication and warned him that you might decompensate if you don't.
I see I'm over my time, but may I respond?
Yeah, please.
He did state that in his declaration, and of course he checked a box in his treatment notes saying medication education provided, but critically what his notes failed to do in violation of Downstate's policies was to explain the content of that education and critically Mr. Suarez's reaction to an understanding of that. In light of that, we believe there's still a tribal dispute as to whether he provided meaningful medication education. And even if the court disagrees with that, Chaim still knew that his course of treatment was going to, in all likelihood, create decompensation. And again, he witnessed signs of active decompensation.
And I have permission from the presider to ask two questions. Let's say we agree with you on the summary judgment standard that applies to the subjective component. Do we remand to deal with the objective component and the qualified immunity claim, or do we resolve them now?
You would remand, Your Honor. As to the objective component, defendants did not move for summary judgment on that, so that would be an issue for trial. As to qualified immunity, as you note, the district court didn't reach that, and so that would be an issue for remand. We would, of course, have arguments as to why qualified immunity is inappropriate here, but that would be an issue for the district court.
Thank you, counsel. You've reserved a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Anika Sundararajan for the appellees. The district court here properly granted summary judgment on plaintiff's deliberate indifference claim because no reasonable jury could conclude, based on this factual record, that any of the individual named defendants subjectively understood that Mr. Suarez faced a substantial risk of serious harm and failed to act in light of that risk.
What do we do with just the very simple fact of Dr. Khayyam's cold turkey taking him off of a significant mental health medication? I know we don't apply the standard in prison. It's the Eighth Amendment is not sort of medical malpractice, right? So
that's
it's
right.
Not a question of whether that was a good idea medically to do, but that, setting aside the knowledge of the symptoms, even setting aside the knowledge of his history, doesn't taking someone off a long-term mental health medication very suddenly require follow-up in a way that sort of, I'm thinking through the subjective prong of this, that sort of suggests there was something wrong there?
Certainly, Your Honor. And there was follow-up here. And I would just like to be very clear, again, because appellees are multiple individuals.
Right.
That would apply only with respect to Dr. Khayyam. It is separate and apart, and I'm happy to address the other defendants if Your Honor would like.
But as to Dr. Khayyam?
Certainly. With respect to Dr. Khayyam, there are a few things in this record that make this different from the normal deliberate indifference case. The first is that it's undisputed that Dr. Khayyam discontinued the prescription only because after meeting with Suarez and evaluating him during an appointment, Suarez repeatedly confirmed that he did not want medication.
The whole factual dispute is whether they should have educated him better on why he shouldn't stop. How does his opinion and his action have any relevance to the inquiry?
So it has a relevance in a few ways, Your Honor. And again, I'd like to be clear, this is limited to Dr. Khayyam. The first is, as Your Honor pointed out, under New York law, Dr. Khayyam cannot override Suarez's refusal. He requires a court order to do so, and the standard for even seeking a court order is extremely high. And based on his individual observations of Suarez at that time, he did not meet the standard under New York law for medication over objection.
And that is not for a jury to decide on whether or not he should have educated him better or whether or not he should have made a conclusion that it was worth it to go to the trouble to get a court order?
So a few other responses to that, Your
Please.
Honor. In addition to that piece under New York law, the second thing that I would note is, as Suarez himself acknowledges, there's no evidence that that additional education would have made a difference. Additionally, Dr. Khayyam was aware of the fact that Suarez was on OMH's treatment schedule, that he was receiving treatment not just from Dr. Khayyam himself, but from other OMH clinicians, that he was being monitored. And finally, Your Honor, under the subjective analysis for the Eighth Amendment, the question is not whether any individual defendant should have drawn a different conclusion from the evidence before them, but rather whether they in fact made that inference. That comes directly from Farmer. And here, there is no evidence that Dr. Khayyam or any of the other named defendants in fact drew that inference, but ignored it anyway. The fact that maybe they should have perhaps goes to a question of negligence or a question of an incorrect medical judgment, but plaintiffs did not bring a negligence action. Their action here is only under the Eighth Amendment, and that is an extremely high bar.
Well, how would you handle Williams, though, which I tend to read as the idea in which clinicians consciously choose an easier and less efficacious treatment that there might be a claim?
Again, Your Honor, we would point to this record, which again, every one of the defendants personally observed Mr. Suarez. They noted that in every interaction over the course of these 2 months, he appeared stable, coherent. He confirmed not only to Dr. Kayyum, but also to his other clinicians, as well as to his social worker, that he did not want medication. And again, this is not a case where someone is ambivalent about his treatment plan or wants something different. This is a case where he is affirmatively telling multiple people that he does not want medication and has a history of not taking his medication.
But he arrived on the medication, right?
He arrived with a prescription, Your Honor. However, he was not taking that medication at Rikers and was not under a medication over objection order because he had regained competence.
But previously, he had been prescribed it and there's no indication that he was, it's sort of this difference between the refusal and the adamancy that suggests and the just saying to your doctor, I don't think I need this. And I guess that's where I'm wondering what the doctor's obligation is. And again, it's not a negligence claim. He can't bring a negligence claim. He's in custody. But what is the doctor's obligation faced with that? Is it to just say, okay, I'm the doctor, you're the patient, but I'm going to go along with your plan? Or does he have some obligation to say, well, sir, I hear you, but you know, in the past, things haven't gone well, and in my experience as a doctor, that may not be a great idea.
So even if he had that obligation here, and even if there's a question of fact about whether he actually fulfilled that obligation here, that at most goes to an error of medical judgment on Dr. Kayyum's part. And that is not enough here to state a deliberate indifference claim, because again, the standard is very high. It is not only whether they should have drawn the inference that something more could have been done, but whether they in fact drew that inference. And there's no evidence here that any of the defendants in fact drew that inference.
So what about the solitary, the shoe placement, and the conditions of confinement claims? I think it's pretty well established now that shoe placement, 23-hour lockdown, all of those things are routinely bad for mental health. And tend to exacerbate symptoms. How do we view those for the non-medical staff?
Certainly, Your Honor. To be clear, there are two non-medical staff here, the superintendent and then the ALJ who actually conducted his hearing. Here, to be very clear about the timeline of what happened, he was taken to SHU pursuant to DOC's policy while his disciplinary proceeding was ongoing. Officer Horan, who was the ALJ in charge of receiving testimony, heard testimony from Ms. DiNardo, one of his clinicians, on August 21st. Again, that was consistent with DOC's policy to have these wrap up within 14 days. And as Officer Horan testified, this is at pages 1895 and 1897 of the record, he understood subjectively that what DiNardo was recommending was that Suarez be removed from SHU as quickly as possible and returned to the general population. The hearing concluded the following day on August 22nd, and Suarez was, in fact, removed from SHU and returned to the general population. He did not lose any privileges. He continued to be able to receive visitors. And he did not lose any good time credit, which means Officer Horan and subsequently the superintendent understood that Suarez would be released from DOC's custody 2 weeks later, which again, in fact, happened. Both Officer Horan and Superintendent Morton were reassured and subjectively believed that regardless of Suarez's placement, OMH clinicians would continue to monitor him. They had no reason to believe that OMH's proposed plan of treatment was ineffective or that he wasn't receiving it, regardless of his placement. And in fact, he was seen by Ms. DiNardo, his clinician, as well as by Dr. Reynolds and his social worker while he was in SHU. He had his regularly scheduled appointments with Dr. Kayyum and again with his social worker for discharge planning and Dr. Reynolds once he was returned to the general population.
So for the prison officials to say they relied on the OMH, the medical personnel, and then the OMH team say, well, we didn't put him in the SHU, that's not our jurisdiction. Doesn't that create kind of a problem, like a finger-pointing situation where collectively you could have a situation where there's maybe enough to rise to deliberate indifference, but since it's kind of dispersed, you don't. The responsibility is spread.
So in this circumstance, that's not a problem, Your Honor, because plaintiffs have chosen to bring individual capacity claims against these particular named defendants. Now, perhaps in the aggregate, there may be something else. That would have been an issue for a separate lawsuit in state court that plaintiffs could have brought within the statute of limitations. But here, the only question before this court is whether each of these individual defendants subjectively understood that Suarez was at risk and subjectively believed that they should have been doing more but failed to do so. Again, that had Suarez chosen to do so, he probably could have brought a claim against the agencies in state court within the relevant statute of limitations period to address exactly the concern that Your Honor pointed out. But this is an individual capacity claim against individual defendants.
When was he released from the SHU?
I believe he was released from SHU on August 22nd, and he was released from DOC's custody on September 5th, I believe. And again, Your Honor, that August 22nd was 14 days.
14 days from the August 8th assault.
Correct. And that was the day his disciplinary proceeding concluded and resulted in a final finding.
Thank you.
Okay. There are no further questions. We ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you. I'm hoping to fit 3 points into my 2 minutes. As to the question of Dr. Khayyam's purported follow-up care after he discontinued the prescription, the record shows that follow-up consisted of Khayyam reflexively following Downstate's default policy of simply seeing Mr. Suarez once every few weeks. The same is true for Kulik and DiNardo. But that sort, this court held in Johnson that that sort of reflexive reliance on a treatment policy that defendants know is not justified in a particular case describes deliberate indifference. Another way of thinking about it is, as Judge Perez mentioned, Williams's principle that knowingly following an easier and less efficacious treatment plan is a question of fact for deliberate indifference. To the extent defendants are arguing that they had no other treatment options available to them short of forcibly medicating Mr. Suarez, the record doesn't support that, certainly not on summary judgment. You know, the Khayyam explained that Mr. Suarez could have been moved to Downstate's FDU unit for more monitoring and treatment. There could have been more frequent sessions. And we say this not to argue that there is some gold standard defendants should have followed. The Eighth Amendment, of course, does not require that. But this is not a case where defendants' hands were tied. Turning to the DOCS defendants and their role, you know, they did not have medical training, of course. But this maybe there are unusual facts here in that both defendants received very specific information about Mr. Suarez's mental health. DiNardo told Horan that Mr. Suarez should not be placed in, quote, disciplinary confinement. Keep lock is a form of disciplinary confinement, even general population keep lock. And so this is a pretty classic example of refusing to follow a medical provider's treatment advice. Because of Morton's participation in the AOT application, he knew that Mr. Suarez's noncompliance with treatment, and of course here it's not a question of noncompliance, but not having that treatment available, would result in further violence and psychosis, yet he did nothing to change Mr. Suarez's conditions of confinement and lack of treatment. And I see I'm over my time, but very quickly to Judge Park, to your question about this dispersion point, I mean, I think this is exactly what we point out in our briefs. The suggestion that that simply because other defendants could have alleviated Mr. Suarez's conditions of confinement or offered treatment that another defendant did not have the obligation to do so, defendants point to no authority suggesting that Eighth Amendment obligations are erased simply because multiple defendants violate somebody's Eighth Amendment rights. If there are no further questions, we'd ask the court reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. We'll take the case under advisement.